And this, listeners, from a person who makes their living feeding other people and catering, and she's saying, no, stay home and cook.
That's right. That's right. Well, you don't have, if it's a, you know, cook for one, cook for two, cook for four, cook for five, you know, we're happy to cook for your larger group when you don't want to do all that. Yeah.
And, you know, mamas out there teach your kids how to cook.
That's right. Mama's teaching and dads.
Yeah. Get your
every parent.
Let your little one crawl on the table and watch him make fudge.
Right. You, every parent, godparent, uncle, aunt, cousin. Yeah. Everybody needs to learn to cook. It's a life-giving skill.
Mary, so wonderful to talk with you today. Happy Earth Day.
Oh, happy Earth Day, Teresa.
And I know for you, every day is Earth Day, but I just am honored to be talking with you today. And good luck with all the hundred of different things you're doing. And I just want to thank you for just being a great food person, an activist, and really helping change food in a meaningful way. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Teresa, for all that you do.
You can listen to Rootstock Radio on the go wherever you get your podcasts. And find us online at rootstockradio.com. Rootstock Radio.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. Listen to Rootstock Radio every Monday at 5:30 on WEFT Community Radio. Coming up next is In the Know, a WEFT-produced public affairs show that highlights locally available resources. Stay with us after that for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater at 7, Monday Night R&R at 8, live local music on WEFT Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901. We're going to get to some underwriting real quick, and then we're going to jump into In the Know.
WEFT is supported in part by Kevin Elliott Counseling. Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including State of Illinois employee insurance, is accepted, and there is also a self-pay sliding scale. Kevin Elliott or his staff can be reached at 398-9066 or ELLIOTTCounselingGroup.com.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign. We are listening now to In the Know. This is a local program and weekly program where I bring in different guests to talk about things going on here in CU as well as on the state level, the national level. We talk about a lot of different social issues in a way that they don't always get a fair shake in other forums. Definitely want to be honest when we're having these conversations. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the guest and the host and not WEFT. Tonight we are talking about the workplace. A lot of times we forget about our everyday grind and forget about the dynamics that happen there. I'm going to let my guest introduce himself and talk a little bit more about his background because he has a wonderful background. I met him back at the Pavilion. So you definitely had a lot of experience with working with colorful personalities. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Mm-hmm. My name's Maurice Mosley. I'm a clinical social worker here in town. Been here since the early 80s. My background is in, mostly working with families, adolescents, things like that. But over the years, it's been kind of evolving. So I find myself working now with groups of people who work together. And it's kind of interesting when you look at it from the perspective of how we behave with people that we spend a great deal of time with.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see some of the same dynamics in the workplace as you will within a family.
Mm-hmm.
Only we tend to focus on work groups more like teams than groups. Group dynamics are constantly in play. Team dynamics, not always.
Yeah. So you had this really great presentation at the Coalition, the Champaign Community Coalition, their monthly meeting. And so what brought that up about? Like, what was the need for it at the time when we're talking about working in, you know, the our everyday grind?
Well, I think the need had more to do with how we communicate even as a community. The community is just a very large group.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes down to our style of problem solving, what happens in groups is there will be these norms in place that determine how we approach things. some of the issues that we have in any community would have to do with how we communicate with each other, how we problem solve, how we deal with our differences. I think in this case, the issue really kind of fit into some other direction that the coalition was going, just in terms of community involvement and more cohesive atmosphere. Mm-hmm. We end up having to talk about the things we typically don't, and venture into areas that, you know, if we're going to be comfortable problem solving, we have to be able to feel comfortable having the conversations. So that presentation had a lot to do with the implicit bias.
Okay.
And really focusing on something that we all have in common. It is, if you're from this planet, you have it. And it's a place to begin a conversation. Mm. Sometimes we try to start the conversations at the most difficult point because of a recent event. But bias is something that we should be talking about all the time.
So when you say implicit bias, for the listeners who aren't familiar with this concept, what are we talking about?
We're talking about our preference, our preferences, essentially. Anything that I feel the way I feel about is a bias. It's based on the circumstances that I bring, my specific history, experience, those types of things. There aren't two people on the planet that are the same, so the chances of us feeling exactly the same about anything are rare. Mm-hmm. Which essentially means bias is a very common occurrence. We kind of give it labels when it shows up in certain places, but the idea that we don't see things the same is pretty universal. Mm-hmm. If we start having conversations there, this is something that we all have to kind of navigate. Mm-hmm. Then it makes us look more for the things we have in common as opposed to our differences. I think that bias, implicit bias in particular, is interesting because it exists at such a low level of awareness. We don't know it's in play. And the only way we'll know it's in play is when it impacts someone else. So on almost all of the circumstances where our bias rises to our awareness, it's with an audience. Someone who's on the receiving end of our bias tells us, here's how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. That means that at the moment we are expected to maybe accept something, maybe a shortcoming of ours, it's with an audience, and we tend to then back away, or our defenses go up. And so now what could have been a moment of learning ends up being a moment possibly of denial, or my defenses just keep me from being able to take that extra step that says, is it possible? Could I have that? Mm. The reality of bias is it's not a secret. It's been around forever. But when it comes to our awareness, it's almost always in circumstances that, you know, it's not the best time to find out something about myself that I maybe need to change. And why is it always with an audience? Can't happen any other way.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, this obviously is something that, like you said, it just occurs naturally. It happens probably fairly frequently. So How do you overcome that specific situation? Because like you said, when people have an audience, they're going to respond possibly differently than they would if the conversation occurred in private. So how do you manage that, especially in a workplace? Because that, you know, I feel like a lot of work settings don't have anything built in to support that type of conversation.
Well, in a work setting, what you have are people who are spending 8 hours a day together, 40 hours a week. Probably a third of their adult lives are spent with people they work with. The workplace itself, though, we aren't staying in jobs as long as we used to. So a lot of these situations, over time, would eventually present themselves. Only after maybe 10 years of working in a job, if me and my coworkers are having a difference of opinion about something, there's an established relationship that we can stretch at that moment. The relationships tend to be stronger than we think they are. And so we can challenge each other because we've been doing it for the past 10 years. When you are new in a job or 3-4 years into the job, you don't have that type of foundation. So disagreement is viewed as disapproval. Mm. And the two are very different.
But right.
Our responses, we defend against disapproval. And disagreement itself, well, it's a pretty normal occurrence, happens all the time. But it shouldn't pinch the way it does. And so when it pinches, it's how I interpret it. it makes it impossible then if we can't talk about disagreements, we can't problem solve.
Right.
And what do you think we do in a workplace when we can't solve a problem? We will find another way to reconcile the problem other than a solution. Typically that means in place of problem solving, we blame.
Mm.
So blame now takes the place of solutions and we adjust to the blame. We start to find really creative ways to avoid blame. Now, ultimately, the only way to avoid blame is avoid accountability altogether, which in a workplace presents a problem all of its own.
Right.
So there's not an option here in terms of how we problem solve in the workplace, or for that matter, anywhere. But when we substitute problem solving for something completely different, whole different purpose, then what could be simply a developmental issue, how soon am I learning something, turns into something more dysfunctional, where I believe the right way is the right way,
mm-hmm.
and the wrong way, well, causes more problems than it's worth.
Right. So, you know, what you were saying about this, you know, we're operating out of our own context, our personal context, and so what you tend to see is how somebody usually operates in their home life or their personal life is how they operate in other settings. And so, you know, we see this all the time. You know, people have unfortunate dynamics at home. There's power struggles and they default a lot to that because it can be hard even in the longest relationships we have in our lives, which typically is with our family, that even in those situations, it can be hard to, you know, acknowledge what we're doing wrong or even acknowledge, or respect somebody else's perspective. You know, I've always said that perception is reality. And so you don't necessarily have to see clearly through their lens for them to feel that this is the reality of this situation. And so when you have this carryover into the workplace, again, you know, there's always different thoughts. Like when I worked with students, it's been, you know, this starts at home. This is something they learned at home. They learned from their caregivers or their family unit. But it's not to say, like you said, that there can't be ways for them to learn in a different setting, a new skill that they can bring back to their home life. You know, I think we discount people's ability to change. But yeah. When you look at the dynamic of family units, when a parent says, you know, I have this implicit bias, if they want to use that language. It's how I was raised. It's how my parents were. It's how my grandparents were. I have a lot of parents who say, you know, how do you change that type of behavior? You know, how do you start the discussion when it comes to something like this? Because I think it can be enough to, like they say, denial's half the problem. So once you get past that denial, how do you start to have these conversations, regardless of what the setting is, to start facilitating change? I mean, because it doesn't happen overnight, and usually I find it involves more than one conversation. It's a sustainable effort.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when you think about it, I try to take advantage of processes that I know are in play to begin with. So, developmentally, there are stages of our growth that are perfect times to make changes in what we've come to believe. We start out pretty much being influenced heavily by our parents' opinions. And almost exclusively our parents during that whole period of time. That gives way to being influenced by our peers. And so we sometimes will deny what we've learned from our parents because, well, they kind of have to like us. But our peers, they can say yes or no. So we get intent on trying to learn from a peer group. That gives way to significant others. So relationships, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. Now these people have a tremendous amount of influence on us. And again, another opportunity to start to rethink what I believe. Ultimately, we're supposed to take all of this experience that we've gained from other people and come up with an understanding of what we believe ourselves. So the last step is when I start listening to me. And probably that is the best time to rethink what I've come to believe.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, we could be well into midlife. We're still probably raising kids, but that's also the time where we're beginning to see some of ourselves in our kids. So there's motivation now, okay? My child came by however their perspective might be. They came by it honestly. I know where they got it from.
Yeah.
I also understand where I got mine from.
Mm.
If I look ahead, that child is going to be making decisions that are contrary to mine. Mm-hmm. Now, is my motivation to keep them thinking the way I do, or am I encouraging them to explore other options?
Mm-hmm.
We have a generation right now of adolescents and young adults that are choosing to do things very differently. And they have an impact not just in their schools or neighborhoods, but across the country. So is the time right for us really looking at how we can change things that actually fit the current experience? You know, the direction we need to go. Yeah, it's absolutely the right time. Mm-hmm. Developmentally, is adolescence a great time to change? Adolescence is nothing but change.
Right.
I mean, there's so much going on during that period of time. You know, you can't even compare it to another kind of developmental stage of life.
Mm-hmm.
What I see different is each generation parents a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
In adolescence right now, is extended. So it takes a little longer period of time, at least what we call that developmental shift. So add 7 years to what we used to consider adolescence, and I have a much longer period of time where we're going through these changes and we're discovering things and we're sorting things out on our own terms. But it means when we enter the workplace, we're still working out some of that stuff. We're still sorting through opposition.
Mm-hmm.
We're still making decisions about whether or not this is a boss we want to listen to. And what about the whole piece where we start to behave like a group? Well, you have to ask a question. In this point in time, are we more motivated by us or me? Because there is, in the workplace, is just a place to consider, but in the workplace, that motivation towards what I need, what I want, is much higher than the mm-hmm. collective piece. But the workplace is a collective environment. We don't hire one individual to do a job, we hire a group of them. We need them to work together. So what happens when there's more of me in the workplace than there is of us?
Mm-hmm.
This is when you'll see the change over time. Each generation comes in with a slightly different approach. It makes a group look like a group, but not really function like a group. So it's harder to predict what the group will do when, at the last minute, the priority is the individual.
Mm-hmm.
It makes everything less predictable, including elections.
We saw that. Mm-hmm. We definitely saw that. There was an expectation when our last federal election came up, and I don't think anybody thought our current administration would be who they are. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also when you're talking about on a national level, the dynamics that we see, that implicit bias, I think people thought was, you know, this idea of, you know, bigotry and, you know, a culture of sexual assault. I mean, we have so many different social issues that have really been in the news. Mm-hmm. Not that this is new. I mean, we've been having these discussions for a long time. But, you know, I said the one thing that maybe our silver lining is that this administration will force us into grassroots efforts, which is really kind of what we've always been predicated on. Is, you know, you've never seen the federal government wake up and say, we're going to overhaul and we're going to really listen to our consumer. It's always been grassroots efforts that have pushed up to the federal level to make change. And so that may be where our silver lining is right now, is that we have people who are finally motivated to see change, if for no other reason on the local level, and hopefully create enough of a storm on the local level that it, you know, it rises to the federal level. So when, you know, you have all these different personalities under one roof, and I'm thinking kind of in the vision of like a teacher with students, you have lots of implicit bias going on there. So as a teacher, you know, what would your suggestion to teachers be to how to manage that? Because you are trying, you have an agenda, you want to educate, that's your priority, but you could have a myriad of problems that happen because of those different personalities and implicit bias.
I think in a classroom, what you have is a potential to do two things. One would be similar to like a focus group, where we get to discuss a topic, but not necessarily exchange our agreements and disagreements. So the question is asked, the group responds, every person can share their opinion. But we aren't challenging the opinions of others. We're simply sharing our own in their presence. Now, the big upside of that is it makes us better listeners. And we also have to hear the entire position. In a lot of cases, we're thinking about how we want to respond while the conversation is going on. And we miss half of it. So a focused approach allows that to happen. It also leads to a process approach. If this group is able to have a focused discussion, it will lend itself to want to engage each other. Now, the process group is a little different because now we do talk directly to each other. We may disagree, but we've gotten accustomed at least to hearing each other all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes us look at our positions. Bias really comes into play when we just assume that our viewpoint is what everybody else believes. A focused approach allows us to hear the other feelings, the other perspectives, without being able to interrupt them.
Mm-hmm.
Most cases, bias is about how much are we willing to, you know, be ourselves in the presence of other people.
Mm-hmm.
How much of ourselves are we will we show people?
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't guarantee their response. Could they disapprove? Might they point out my own bias? Who knows? But bias exists, at least implicit bias. It's such a low level of awareness, there isn't another way to find out until it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
But as it goes up, implicit bias moves to explicit bias. Now my awareness is higher. And explicit bias comes in the form of, you know, my prejudice about something. It's a bias. It just exists at a higher level of awareness. I know I have this belief. A discrimination is an even higher level of awareness. I have this belief that affects my behavior, so I'm acting on this belief. And then all of the isms at the top, I have a high level of awareness if I'm up here in the ism area because I'm trying to influence the environment around me. So I could be in a parade versus where implicit bias would be, where it's not even at a level of awareness.
Right.
These discussions where the awareness is high, those are more difficult discussions to have. I just don't think it's possible to have those if we can't have the ones that really address implicit bias, the things that we all have in common.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an awareness step by step.
Mm-hmm.
The whole piece about understanding when my bias comes to the forefront, it's because someone told me.
Mm-hmm.
Those make the circumstances difficult for me to accept it because I have to accept two things at the very same time. I just found out something about myself that I didn't know. And it appears everybody knew but me. And so I have to manage both those things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's... I have a 13-year-old, and so I know that some of our discussions is bringing it to her attention. Hey, this is the message you're sending me. And in her mind, she's thinking, that's not at all what I was trying mm-hmm. to say. And so I know that whether you're a teacher or a parent or just anybody who, you know, works with adolescents, you know, I even found this at the college level when I was teaching financial wellness. You know, they had a very specific mentality when it came to how they were, you know, their financial wellness and their spending habits, and didn't recognize, you know, their bias at all. So in your presentation, you talked about how to de-bias our decisions. So what does that look like? Because that sounds like maybe a lofty goal for some people.
It really depends on the context. Because, yeah, it could be a lofty goal. What I'm really looking at when I'm trying to take into consideration the existence of a bias is I'm going to make a decision a certain way. And early on in my decision-making process, a lot of that is based on what I believe I already know. And so I'm not considering whether or not to build on this information. I'm just building on it. If I were going to kind of catch my bias, I would have to change my process. So instead of saying, here's the direction I think I should go, I might have three possible directions that I should go. I might choose two extremes and one somewhere in the middle. So the outcome should be this, or this thing way over here, or somewhere in the middle. Now I'm starting to look at things from a perspective that says, okay, this script isn't written yet. I don't have a lot of information that I would start out believing. And when I deliberately look at it from different perspectives, it makes me consider both the possible outcomes, and plus everything in between. So adding choices helps us kind of derail the bias. Sometimes I can walk away from a situation and come back to it and look at it from a different perspective, because there are times where we get stuck and we put a lot of thought in trying to understand the solution, and eventually we get tired and we go to bed. The next morning we get up and we might come back to the same place we were and immediately see another perspective that we had missed before, because we had really locked ourselves into, I have to follow this line of reasoning, and the answer has to be somewhere on this line, and it really doesn't have to be that way. I've seen some of the best resolutions I've ever seen come from extremely opposing groups, because they were looking at things from very different perspectives. Not because they agreed on anything, but simply neither had considered what it looked like to view it from way over there.
Mm.
There's this thing too, similar to like a postmortem, only it's a premortem. And essentially, I create an outcome in my mind, like here's how this thing will turn out. And I make this thing turn out as a failure. Now, it hasn't happened, but I'm saying, all right, what if this happened and it failed? Before I know anything, I can now ask the question, what could have made it fail? I don't have any information, I don't have any data, the thing never happened. But it's making my mind consider, without pre-existing information, what could have brought me to this place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm creating this cause and effect from an event that hasn't occurred. There's no risk. Whatever might stress me, pressure me to go to my go-to decision making, not there. I can just sit back and fabricate what probably caused that problem.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading something about, oh, well, the big business thing was Home Depot wanted to open up stores in China. They kind of started the process, and then it failed. And the assumption was that people everywhere liked home improvement, but people everywhere don't do it themselves. And so the bias was attached to the way we do things, maybe, but over there, you got a lot of people who have a lot of skills and they're doing very different things with their time. It's easier to hire somebody to fix it. Home Depot wasn't going to do too well. Those are the types of things that influence the market, is how much do we know about the decisions that we're making?
Mm.
And how do you step out of yourself? Ultimately, we have to accept the reality that we all have these biases, and that if I see yours, then you see mine. And we need to be more accepting of each other's biases, because mm-hmm. I may need you to tell me what mine are. I mean, you ever consider, I remember once I was talking to my son about bias, and I said, I have a bias, and it's about the way people drive. I know it's not true, but I know I have this bias. And he would witness me, you know, as we're driving. I would talk about this person's driving, that person's driving, so on and so on. So, and this was when he was very young. So I'm with him in the car once, and he makes a statement about this woman driving. Now, he didn't drive yet.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know how to drive.
Mm-hmm.
His bias came directly from me. And it occurred to me that, okay, yeah, I probably could have picked a better circumstance, but if I had to hear this from somebody that would actually make me reconsider, it would have been coming from him. And so it shaped me at that point in terms of, you know, being aware of what I say and what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But the part that I think we should accept, readily accept, is that it's everywhere. It mm-hmm. cannot help but exist. Our brain processes just an enormous amount of information. I think neuroscientists say 11 million bits of information in a second.
Wow.
Now, we are only consciously aware of 40 bits of information. So where's the other 10 million and some odd bits of information go? Well, we don't have to be aware to be affected. So we still have the information, are affected by it, we store it, we do all those things. And it influences our decision making, but not on a conscious level. Mm-hmm. So bias is at least in part due to the way our brains process information. We categorize it, we sort it, it's all based on what's the best way to retrieve it. We make assumptions about information that we don't remember. We fill in the gaps, mm-hmm. and we're just making up stuff then. But we have to come to a conclusion, and in a timely manner. And the result is it creates bias, simply because we can't manage all of this information. Our brains are phenomenal when it comes to picking up and storing information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, consider that our sensitivity to our surroundings, that's different for everybody too. We all have varying levels of sensitivity for different things. But that does dictate how much data I'm picking up. So a very sensitive person is picking up a lot of data. Their five senses are communicating a tremendous amount of information. Now, that's true for all of us. Our senses are always at work. They don't shut off. And they're giving us information about how we're being affected. It's all true information, because we wouldn't notice it if we weren't affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be translated by either by our thoughts, our feelings, or our behavior. And our feelings are also involuntary. So we have five senses pulling involuntary data. And then our feelings interpreting
mm-hmm.
involuntarily. You were affected this way. The more you process, the more information you have to process. I'm picking up a lot. My brain's got to go to work. It tends to affect how smart we are.
Mm-hmm.
Highly sensitive people, like Albert Einstein, was considered a highly sensitive person. And he was understanding physics and all kinds of equations in his head, simply because that's where he was accustomed to working. If we were to look at things in terms of that, that the way we process information, it requires us to make decisions, interpretations about what we're being affected by. It's another place where the information has to be interpreted, and it could be interpreted very uniquely by whoever it is. But there are relatively few, if any, situations where it doesn't require us to make a decision that's based on either a lack of information or too much information, or having to process a decision quickly, not having the time to think about it, or some other factor that essentially they create four types of biases based on the circumstances that made us draw conclusions. There are, right now at least, 260 some odd known biases where we know they exist and we know the circumstances. And they are not all related to, you know, race or skin color or anything else like that. There's a bias called the Google effect. And the Google effect says that we have a bias about retaining information that we find on the web, because we know where to find it now, so we're not holding on to it. And then the search engines remind us of that by bringing us back to our last search, because we know we're going back to ask the same question again, because we didn't retain any of this information.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of aspects of how we educate kids that makes them ask the same question. Am I going to need this? If I don't have to need this, then why should I remember it? Or, I'm studying to pass the test. After the test, I can't tell you what I studied, because it was just long enough to pass the test, and that was it. So these are all influenced by our bias on what we choose to prioritize, what we choose to say is worth holding on to, or I can catch up with it later. There's a bias that really has to do with our preference to not be creative in our solution seeking, our problem solving. We're faced with a priority that says, okay, we don't have an answer, but we need one, and we need it now. Now, my level of comfort without having an answer is just so much. And after a while, I will compromise a creative process that might come up with an innovative answer for one that just gives me an answer. And so my bias is actually about creativity. It takes too long. I'm not that patient. I need an answer sooner. And so what we might see is the compromise of creative solutions as a result of the need to have an answer. That's a bias. They come in every shape and form that you can imagine. And tremendous effect on our behavior and our belief system.
Mm-hmm. How do you think social media has affected this? Because now we have this almost whole other, you know, entity that just really affects really everybody. I mean, everybody thinks that you see it. Oh, parents think that their kids are consuming it, but then parents are scrolling through Facebook mm-hmm. when they get home from work. So this is something that once it established itself, I mean, it's everywhere. It's, you know, companies talk about that piece of how do we use social media to influence. There's now this whole idea of what's called influencers who are on Instagram and Facebook, and their whole purpose is just to feed those ideas to their audience. And so, you know, like you said, I can totally believe that we have all this stimuli inundating us all the time because we now have a whole new source for information. So how do you think social media has affected it? And do you see it as a positive or a negative effect?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I have a bias with social media. and partially because it assumes the position of taking the place of a whole lot of other things that we used to rely on in order to clarify communications. If you and I are having a face-to-face conversation, there's a whole lot of nonverbals that exist in this conversation. We both are interpreting information that is based on engaging more than one of our senses. Social media pretty much says what's on the media is what you will be influenced by, and it doesn't require a whole lot of interpretation. It is telling you what to believe. In fact, the fight on social media is which of the things that are available on social media to believe. I can't help but to think that there was a time where the sources of our imagination and all of our processing and all of the things that we come up with, the source was not social media. There was a time where it did not happen at all. And we came up with some pretty creative stuff over those years. Since social media, what I have seen is a lot of revisiting past experiences, you know, throwback Thursday kind of thing. Where we're real, and you're seeing, I remember singing the words to a song, and some younger people asked me how I knew this song. And I said, the song's older than you are. Well, they could not believe that was an old song that was remade 8 times, and they had come to know it in this format. But I recognized the song from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was prior to social media. You end up having to be more creative mm-hmm. in terms of how you process and problem solve. You rely more on direct engagement. We rely more on email. You can't interpret feelings over email, so you need 10, 11 exchanges before you can make your point where it's clear enough to act on it. We've placed ourselves in a position where we're accustomed to making the translation. We'll say, okay, well, what does it take to interpret it this way? But in terms of how we're wired, human beings have needed each other since the beginning of time. We would not have survived if we did not form communities, work together, stick it out, all the things that made us who we are. Technology, including social media, might convince us that we don't need each other. And so we rely much more on than making these connections that are kind of, well, they're not real connections in the space that I would say I would have with people that I talk with every day. They're virtual connections mm-hmm. that we're trying to make more real.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just having real ones.
Mm-hmm.
People get upset with me because I don't answer my cell phone. And, you know, I'm a counselor. My phone's off 8 hours a day. And I sometimes forget to turn it back on. But I remember a time when the phone was on the table in the dining room. And if you weren't in the dining room when it rang, you didn't get the message. And everybody was okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different time now where people get upset with you without if you're not available all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes us more impatient with each other. And the reality is, I don't know if I want to be chained to my phone and be available to everybody all the time. So I think we really have to take a look at the role that social media plays in terms of its usefulness, but also in terms of how it limits us. I don't think that human beings are designed to live separately, to live alone. You put a human being on an island, in a couple of days he'll create another human being.
We saw that in Castaway. He made a person out of a volleyball.
Now, how desperate are we for contact with each other if we can't tolerate our absence? You know, being disconnected. We punish people by socially isolating them. How is that a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
I remember the power went out on my block, and I met neighbors I didn't know I had. Because everybody's out in the street. In an instant, we needed each other. But before that, we're self-sufficient, didn't need anybody, got all the technology I need.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will come to bear in terms of the types of information we seek and what we hold on to. Are we holding on to the information that creates depth, or is it really superficial information that we're probably going to forget in a few days?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we see that when we have large events that affect us. You know, when 9/11 happened, you saw a whole country that banded together. So I think it's innate in us as humans to do that. You know, you see, you know, it's like social media, I a lot of times I see is kind of the news. We don't report all the planes that take off and land safely. We just report the ones that go down. And social media can sometimes drive, I think, that aspect of I'm in this chaotic world and, you know, humans are not necessarily, you know, their compassion isn't inherent. And I do think to some degree we see that with social media. It's a safe place. We're not having to face somebody. We can post whatever we want and the consequences aren't immediate because mm-hmm. we're not having to face somebody. And that's usually what I've cautioned my students about is you said it, it's out there. You just didn't have to own it in the moment because you weren't saying it to somebody's face. You said it via text. You said it on, you know, social media or group message. And so I do think there is a break with that. But at the same time, the same students will rally around each other to support each other. So I think it's a balance. One of my guilty pleasures is watching this show called American Gods. And it's an interesting show, and I've had to explain it to my 13-year-old because one of the episodes she caught a clip of was talking about the new gods versus the old gods. And one of the new gods is media and another is technology. And she was just kind of confused, like, why would anybody watch a show about that? I said, but this is more real world than you think it is right now, because I do think we struggle a lot with who humans are inherently and who we're becoming because we have this dependency, you know, on technology. But when it comes to, you know, community efforts, you know, which is what the coalition was striving for, you now have, you know, even more, I think, dynamics to consider. So when you're working on community building and you know that implicit bias is there, and I think working through that, all the biases is important to have communities that work together. You know, when some people ask the question, where do you start with this? How do you start with that to bring communities together where it's not just, oh, this is, you know, a certain part of town, it's their problem, and we're over in this safer part of town, so we don't need to make that effort. How do you bridge those biases?
Well, on a community level, it would seem to have to focus on what we perceive as differences that keep us apart, because differences exist all over the place mm-hmm. and they always have. But how we respond to them. When we look at differences, we look at ways that we are separate. We're looking at ways that we are different and need to be or choose to be. But we don't just stop the fact that we're different. We have to give it a purpose that says, and so we should be separate or we should view people differently. It is kind of a race. You know, our awareness of bias and the existence of it and a no-fault nature of it. That is racing against things we've brought with us that says, you know, our differences in this country are becoming more and more apparent. The whole color scheme of the country is changing. Our belief that differences are bad impacts then how we respond to that type of a situation. In reality, just in terms of groups, the way groups work, homogeneous work groups are less effective than heterogeneous groups. And I mean, if I believe that everybody in my group, because we all maybe look the same, probably all think the same, then I won't look. I will assume that you will agree with what I agree with.
Mm.
If everybody in my group looks different backgrounds, sizes, shapes, colors, I'll assume we probably don't see things the same way. But it opens the door for me to find out more about things I don't know than if I view the group as we all kind of think the same or work the same. You put groups of kids together to work together, and the more they have differences, the better the group will work. Because the first task is, okay, so how do we bridge our differences? What do you know that I don't know? What do we look at from very different perspectives that could actually help us solve a problem? And will we listen to each other right off the bat? Will we take use of this information that could help us come up with a better end result? It is that disconnect that says we're not the same, but that could be an advantage. It's that I always say that sometimes the question isn't the first one, it's the second one. It's like, I could question why someone is able to irritate me. I could wonder why they keep doing it. I might even ask them, why do you do this to me? But the second question, okay, this person is pressing my button. Where did I get the button? Hmm. That's a much better question to ask, because that one I can probably figure out the answer to. Why some person does something on some random day towards me today, I'll never get an answer for that. Mm-hmm. But I might get an answer for why it bothers me. It's our willingness to take a look at ourselves and raise our awareness of who we are. It tends to be a much better outcome than trying to assume that if nobody today does any of these things that irritate me, I will have a good day. It's like starting out your day with a list and standing on your front porch saying, don't anybody do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm needing to have a good day, and I'm counting on you all to not behave in a way that affects me. Or I could change one person's behavior, my own, as opposed to trying to change everybody else's. It's how we look at things. But looking at ourselves, I think, is always a plus, and the willingness to do that. Wouldn't you love it if we could get to that day where we can ask each other, so, is my bias showing? is it out there? Because I'm not going to know. I'm counting on you all to tell me. Now we're looking at bias as something that potentially brings people together instead of pushes them apart. Because
mm-hmm.
we cannot navigate our biases without each other. There's just no way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to push us apart. It could be that thing that unifies us, because we all have it. And some of them are really funny biases. They're hysterical. There's a bias called I Knew It All Along bias. And it says that after the fact, once I understand the answer, I will come up with a belief that says I knew it the whole time. It's a bias. We could laugh at some of the biases, and they're not going to decrease, they're just going to increase. The more we talk, the more we see our differences.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're ready to approach problems related to bias a little differently than we have in the past. And it all involves our willingness to talk about it. And not just the ones specific to race and religion and politics. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Get comfortable with the conversation. Then we take on the more difficult ones.
How do you see bias being rooted in mental health?
I think that it comes into play with our belief about what mental health is.
Mm.
We assume mental health, ooh, bad thing. If I said someone was really good at taking care of their physical health or really great at working out, it would be a positive thing. But mental health, if you are focused on being mentally healthy, well, some of us could see that in a negative light.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's possible, then it might affect how I see myself seeking help for mental health issues. How will I be viewed?
Mm-hmm.
Some of the reasons that I started working with groups was because I would go to the group
mm-hmm.
instead of them come into the office. And it makes a big difference, because I'm talking to people now that may never come into the office.
Yeah.
And in the context of the work they do. So it's applied immediately. It's not something that I'm just learning about myself. I'm learning about myself in this particular environment and how that impacts things. So, yeah, there is a bias that's attached to the concept of mental health. And it affects then how we seek services, how we deliver services. But it's as normal as a bias.
Mm-hmm.
Mental health is something that requires some time and attention of everybody. It's not a bad thing, but it's got a history.
Yeah. When I teach financial wellness workshops to social workers throughout the state of Illinois, the first thing that we talk about is bias. Because, again, people don't always recognize, like you're saying, they don't always recognize that what's coming out is rooted somewhere. They just think it's kind of the default, or everybody else believes this way. And so sometimes when we're talking about, even when I taught a course at the Danville Correctional Center, again, we're talking about bias from the very beginning, because people think that there's standards. I think that's the sometimes the correlation I see is people jump from the bias, which they don't always recognize, to, but this is just the standard. This is how everybody thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can also be rooted in culture, gender. But a lot of times the conversations just develop to the point where there's almost this light bulb situation where somebody says, I never looked at it that way before because I just assume this is how everybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I assume that this is the approach that every social worker would use. And you get these wildly different, you know, opinions. So I think this is one of the efforts that we should see in really every, there should be something built in schools, in workplaces, really everywhere where you can have these types of communications, because that's, you know, what I tell my students, communication is almost always the root of a problem because somebody's not willing to say something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting when you see people having these discussions, even in restorative practices, when we're trying to, you know, uncover what's going on and what people need and what their feelings are. At some point, there's usually that moment where somebody says, I get it now. So if there's, are there any exercises that can be practiced, whether it's a school setting, a work setting, that people can start to kind of work on this issue?
Well, I think there's some things that are probably already being done in the schools that really has to do with just leading the discussion. I think over the years, what happens in discussions is can be unpredictable in the sense that any individual's willingness to share their perspective, regardless of what they anticipate, is potentially a very good situation because it encourages others to do the same,
uh-huh.
even if they challenge it. You're better off hearing the different perspectives than not. It's our level of comfort with things. I think that if we were going to really work on improving something, it would be our tolerance for disagreement. You know, disagreement and disapproval are very different, but they get confused. And if our tolerance for disagreement were higher, we could hear each other more. But that means we first have to figure out the difference between disapproval and disagreement, because what I see is a lot of confusion there. If I disagree with you, the assumption might be that I disapprove of you.
Mm.
And if we do that, we're not having a conversation anymore because I somehow passed judgment. And in truth, no, that's just a low tolerance for disagreement.
That's a good point.
We live in a performance-oriented society, and from day one, we're grading our kids. So approval is something that comes in massive doses all the way through high school, just from the school system and how we teach and how we learn.
Mm-hmm.
That carries on, though, where we have to apply it to real life. And there it's not about a right answer. it's maybe about the best answer for this circumstance or for this particular time. But we are still motivated to be right. And right and wrong is different, is no different than win-lose. Mm-hmm. It creates two extreme outcomes and the only outcomes. Now, how often is it that half the time we anticipate an outcome that we'll be disappointed and the other half the time we'll be delighted?
Right.
That doesn't exist anywhere on this planet. It's an unrealistic expectation. The worst case scenario is rare, mm-hmm. but we prepare ourselves for it every time.
We do. Yeah.
So just being a little more realistic about outcomes and accepting disagreement is not the end of the world.
It's not. Although when you're living with a teenager, it feels like that. Well, thank you for coming on the show. This is definitely, you know, again, one of those things where I think the more we talk about it, the more people understand exactly what this means. Because, you know, a lot of the concepts that you talked about, I think people have misconceptions about, or they don't quite understand that, like you said, disapproval and disagreement. People tend to misjudge those, I think, a lot more than just being able to sit and say, this doesn't necessarily always have to be, you know, a right answer or the perfect answer. We just have to have an answer that hopefully will, you know, really work for everybody involved. I know, you know, just from parents being able to open their mind a little bit and hear, or even like you were saying, see themselves and the decisions their students are making, that can be hard. We have those mirrors that are held up to us all the time. But thank you, Morris, for coming on the show. I will have you back because there's always more to talk about when it comes to implicit bias work. Tune in next week at 6 o'clock. I will have another guest. And just tune in every week from 6 to 7 on Mondays. Always a good conversation that's going on. See you later, guys.